We humans, on the other hand, are constantly fretting about, you know, what's going to happen next, or worrying about, you know, what happened before. And it's those cycles of predicting some imaginary future or ruminating about some, you know, foregone past that I think keep us trapped in these negative thought patterns and these negative emotions.
That's J. Eric Oliver, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. J. Eric Oliver is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago and host of the Knowing podcast. He joins us to talk about how to know yourself, the art and science of discovering who you really are. Eric, welcome to Conversations.
Dan, thank you so much for having me. It's great to meet you. And thanks for having the book right there. Appreciate it.
Well, before we talk about that book, let's talk about your search for the meaning of self, how it led to this class you teach, and eventually the book.
Yes, I think if I had to pinpoint a place where it started for me was in my high school English class, where my high school English teacher wrote, "Know thyself" on the blackboard. And she said, in these two words, were the collective wisdom of the ancient Greeks. And if we wanted to have a meaningful life, we needed to know the self. So I took her word seriously, and I spent the next four decades trying to figure out this elusive self. And I read philosophy, and I studied psychology, and I delved into neuroscience, and I studied Eastern, you know, religious traditions, went on long meditation retreats, and eventually culminated in teaching a class here at the University of Chicago on how to know yourself, where I brought together all these different wisdom traditions and ideas, and to explore what's behind this whole experience of being that we currently have.
And before we delve into it, just a few things, because there's so much here, there's no way we can discuss it all. Give us a brief overview. What are readers going to find in this book?
Well, my aim in writing this book is to help people expand the vocabulary of their own lived experience. And as I describe in the book, I think a lot of us carry around a lot of unproductive emotions or thoughts. I describe this in the story of carrying around a honey wagon, where we sort of drag these sort of unnecessary weights behind us that keep us from living as well as we might otherwise do. And if we want to unshackle ourselves from these burdens, we need to have some sort of conceptual tools to understand what's going on. And so really my main purpose in writing the book is to try to provide people with some of these tools that they can begin to rethink their own assumptions about who they are or how they live in the world.
Just the notion of self, as you point out in the book, is not simple. It's multi-layered. You can look at a physical self, you can look at a sort of mental self, maybe a spiritual self, if that's part of how you look at the world. And it becomes very complicated very quickly.
It does. And I think that's one of the biggest misapprehensions we have about our own being. We think of ourselves as singular, stable, even eternal people who are in some ways are fixed and unchanging. But once you begin to really delve into, okay, well, what am I? What's behind this whole experience of me? You quickly see that there's nothing fixed about you. You are a process, as I like to describe, or a set of processes. And what is exciting about that is processes can change. They can be constantly updated and improved. And in some ways that begins, I think, the first step in kind of claiming what I believe is our birthright, which is a much more effervescent and joyous way of existing on the planet that we don't often see, or we get clouded out because we get so compressed in unproductive emotions or unhelpful thought patterns.
Now, one of the things that is fascinating to think about that obviously a lot of people don't, because you say that, you know, we think of ourselves as a singular physical being, for example. But as you point out, that as we age, all those cells get replaced. So we're certainly not the same being we were when we were born. And then we have trillions of creatures living inside us that comprise us. So, you know, what are we really? And how do all those little creatures in us influence ultimately who we are?
And this is really a fascinating thing. When you start looking at your biology, you discover that you're really more of a we than a me. So, for example, within each of our cells are these little creatures called mitochondria. And we might know of them as they help, they're the energy power sources of the self, but they all have their own DNA. And what that means is that even at a cellular level, we are a hybrid of two different species that are coexisting together. And of course, most people know that we have a microbiome, you know, thousands of species and billions of these other creatures that live all through us, particularly in our gut. They can be about 5 pounds of our body's weight, and they perform some vital services for us as well. And then there's just the fact that we live in culture. We understand and know the world through words and languages and ideas that were bequested to us from other people. And so everything about our essence is a social phenomena. There's really much less of a singular I there than a collection of we's that are generating this sense of I to help negotiate, you know, this body get through the world. But it's really much more social. And I find some actually profoundly spiritual ideas from that. Like, so when I go out and I walk in nature now, I see other creatures that are doing the same thing. I'm like, oh, we're all kind of cousins in this one underlying life force that traces back to our single-celled ancestor that lived about 3.7 billion years ago. And that had this life force that generated this self. And everything that we've seen is an elaboration of that. And I find great comfort and connection in that. I'm like, oh, this life experience is all around us. And that feeling of lonely isolation I sometimes carry about, I find I can really kind of alleviate when I get in touch with all these other life forms around me.
If you start expanding that, as you do a bit in the book, as you point, we're more like a we, and then we have this relationship with all these other living creatures on the planet, and then there's the planet in our solar system, in the universe, et cetera, et cetera, and it keeps going out. And on one hand, as you point out, you can look at it and say, well, this is kind of comforting that we're all part of this grand scheme of whatever it is. On the other hand, we're also very insignificant.
Right. And I think that becomes the interesting question for us, which is, on the one hand, it is a little daunting to think, oh, I'm like a little tree. I mean, I'm like a little leaf on the tree of life. I'm not sort of the grand definitive flower as much as I'd like to believe that I am. And in some ways, that's really a gut punch because it's like, oh, my existence doesn't matter that much. But then I should just ask myself, well, why am I so preoccupied with my importance in the first place? And I think that's really the key of wisdom there is beginning to let go of that oversized sense of importance, or that's not necessarily where life's purpose comes in, is in, you know, making that next achievement or, you know, fulfilling some kind of destiny. That there's a more subtle and quiet way of really fulfilling our purpose in life. And that's in terms of optimizing these self-processes, these myriad self-processes that are really animating this existence.
So help me understand this. Given all we just talked about, how do we define self and how do we discover that self?
Sure. And you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was that there are hundreds of books out there that are trying to tell us how we can help ourselves. And none of them really describe what the self is that they're trying to help. And the same goes with philosophy. There's no one definition of what the self is. So when I was doing this work, I was trying to figure out, okay, what's a useful definition that I could come up with? And the way to understand that is to first understand that at our core, at our very deepest level, we are energy systems. Everything in the universe is an energy system, but we are living energy systems. And living energy systems do something that's really unique in the universe. We resist entropy. Entropy is the great degradation of the universe. It's this large process of unfolding that we're seeing in the universe as its energy potential begins to decline over time. And everything in the universe is acceding to this except life. Life pushes back against this. It takes in free energy and regenerates itself and keeps itself going. And the self are all the ways that life does this. It's the way, so this is my definition of the self. It's all the processes that negotiate between this life force, this animating fire that keeps us alive, and reality. And it starts with our cells and their way that they're metabolizing energy. It builds up as a multicellular creature that's mapping the world through its perceptions and sensations and making predictions about what is going to happen next. As humans with language, it manifests in the rules and structures and cultural ideas that we put together. On an individual level, it manifests in the sense of identity and a name that I have for myself. I'm Eric, I'm a professor. You know, I kind of want people to like me. I want to, you know, expand and go in the world. And then ultimately, I think there's a level of self-process that I would call the transcendent self, which seeks to kind of rebalance and find a better way of living amongst all of these other layers of being that constitute these self processes.
Part of what I'm taking from this, even though the idea of self is very complicated, when you put all these things together, we're a unique combination of those things. So we have, you know, a unique spot in the world because of how we perceive things and all of our experiences, et cetera. So what does this book have to say about purpose? Once we decide, okay, this is me, this is myself, what's my purpose in life?
And yeah, I talk about this in the book. Like when I was a young age, I was raised Catholic, and I think I found most of my purpose in life early on through the teachings of the Catholic Church. But when I was a teenager, I left my Catholic faith, and that prompted a really big existential crisis for me because I didn't know what my purpose was anymore without the sort of the guiding wisdom of my church's beliefs. And so in some ways, this is what prompted this journey that I've been on. Is there a way to discover that purpose? And I found a great answer from Aristotle. And Aristotle said, if you want to know anything's purpose, you need to see its function. So for example, a hammer's purpose is to smash things. So, you know, a purpose-driven hammer would try to smash things as well as it could. And he said the same thing applies to us. If we want to understand what our true purpose in life, we have to know what our function is. And to understand our function, it goes back to what is the self trying to do? And the self is out there, you know, negotiating with reality and keeping this flame of life alight. And it has to do this in two ways. It has to keep itself ordered. It has to make sure that that flame of life keeps burning and keeps the right amount of fuel going in. But it also has to have the flame itself. And I call these things order and vitality. And it's the way we organize our energy and the flow of the energy itself. And we want them to be in a harmonious balance. And biologists have a word for this. They call it homeostasis. And we want to find the most efficient and optimal way of existing in this energy flow. And once we can find that way, as I mentioned earlier, I think a much more effervescent and radiant way of existing becomes available to us. And part of our challenge right now is that we live in a lot of imbalances. We carry around a lot of unproductive emotions. We get very compressed in unhelpful thoughts. And we get so distracted with that, that we aren't aware of a much more luminescent, you know, experience of being that sort of exists just below the ordinary surface of consciousness.
Well, one of the tools you talk about in the book, because there are so many distractions in our lives, is to be in the moment. Because you write, I'm going to paraphrase this a little bit, you write that this present moment is the only true time that exists.
Right. And I think this was one of the reasons why our species went off the rails a little bit is once we started learning how to speak and once we had words, we became aware of the past and the future. And not only did we become aware of the past and the future, you know, all other animals exist in the now. They don't really think beyond a very short time horizon one way or another. We humans, on the other hand, are constantly fretting about, you know, what's going to happen next or worrying about, you know, what happened before. And it's those cycles of predicting some imaginary future or ruminating about some, you know, foregone past that I think keep us trapped in these negative thought patterns and these negative emotions. And the more that we can just be in this present moment and aware of all and open to the vast amount of information coming in a way that's less reactive and just more observant, the richer our experience of the moment becomes and the richer our overall experience of being becomes.
I want to come back to something you said at the beginning and something you write in the introduction, and that the purpose of the book is not really to know yourself so much as it is just to live a better life.
Right. And I mean, that's, I'm an academic. I'm very curious about ideas. So at some level, knowing the self, I get very enchanted by just these ideas. And I have a lot of ideas in the book that I just found fascinating to think about. You know, we were talking about one, like, for example, mitochondria. It's just fascinating to think that here I am comprised of these different species. But at some level, we want to use this knowledge and have this knowledge help us live better. And, you know, with my students, when I teach this class around this material, I say, okay, we're not just going to read these authors or think about these ideas. I want you to tell me how these ideas help you reinterpret your own experience. And when the students start doing that, they just come alive. And it becomes very transformative for them because they begin to rethink oh, all of these assumptions about who they were or how they should be. And maybe they are living according to stories that they had no hand in writing, that they think that they're, we all like to think that we're the author of our own life story. But most of the stories we live by were ones that were bequested to us from others. They weren't the ones that we wrote ourselves. And I think part of wanting to live a more free and autonomous way is learning how to become the author of your own stories.
So there's so much more in this book that we won't have time to talk about. What would you say are some of the key takeaways that you hope readers will take from the book?
Well, I would have a couple, one of which is you're not a noun, you're a verb. As we discussed earlier, you're really a process. And part of that process and part of getting that process to, you know, work in a more optimal way is engaging your curiosity and starting to become curious about, oh, well, why am I doing those types of things? And then the second part is finding tools to help you better apprehend what's going on. Like I said before, my purpose in writing this book is to try to provide people a better vocabulary for their own lived experience. And there are lots of other traditions out there that provide such tools. And I try to bring a lot of them into the book. And then the third part is once we can begin to identify where our imbalances are in our self-processes, we can take the next, and in some ways the most difficult step, which is letting go of them. And I think this is oftentimes very counterintuitive for us because our minds think that we need to hold on to our anxieties or our resentments or our unproductive thinking states because we think that at some level they're necessary for our survival. We learn that maybe at some early age. And the fact of the matter is they're not. I would say that most of my thoughts probably aren't helping things all that much when I go through an ordinary day. And so learning to just stop in each moment and say, okay, is this thought helping anything? No. Maybe I don't need to be thinking so much. Maybe I can be just, you know, deliberate and intentional without getting so wrapped up in the thoughts in my head. And when I could be in that kind of space, it's just a much better and more luminescent way of being.
In addition to the book, which people can learn more through reading it, you also have a podcast. Tell us about your Knowing podcast.
So when I started working on the book, my wife Thea said, oh, well, maybe you should talk to some people who are not 21 about how they know themselves. And so I started interviewing people and started offering a podcast about that. And the first podcast was called 9 Questions, but we realized it's more than just 9 questions. And so we've rebranded it as Knowing. And what I try to do in the podcast is find really interesting people who have a particular expertise that can share some wisdom for us about either our own experience of being or how the world around us is operating. And so we're going to try to move from just asking about things or guessing about things to knowing about things. And that's really what the podcast is all about.
To learn more, the book is How to Know Yourself, The Art and Science of Discovering Who You Really Are by J. Eric Oliver. Eric, thank you for talking with me today.
Dan, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to the latest episodes on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.